Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Quick, name the president who's on the dime, or think about the letters and numbers on your license plate. Were you stumped for a moment? That's the strange thing about the powers of observation. We can look at something 1,000 times and never really notice it. Our struggle to notice what's around us is even worse in our smartphone age, where we often have tunnel vision that limits itself to a little handheld screen. My guest today wrote a book that aims to help us recapture the keen use of our senses. His name is Rob Walker, and he's the author of The Art of Noticing. And he argues that tuning into things normally overlooked not only provides fodder for art and business, but can make life seem more vibrant and engaging. Rob and I begin our conversation discussing what it means to notice and the benefits that come from noticing. We then spend the rest of the conversation walking through several exercises you can start doing today to strengthen your noticing muscles, including creating observational scavenger hunts and collections. Rob also suggests several ways to notice overlooked things at museums and why looking at the world like there's a dramatic heist about to go down causes you to notice more in your environment. Lots of great insights in the show. After it's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/noticing. Rob joins me now via clearcast.io. Rob Walker, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brett.
So you just published a book called The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. So what got you noticing?
Well, I guess a couple of things. One of which is going to be pretty obvious. I probably don't have to spend a lot of time discussing the idea that we're living in this, you know, information shoving economy of ideas where everyone's trying to get your attention. We're in a time of distraction, and it's partly down to our phones and stuff like that, but it's also just the nature of society now. Like, everybody wants your attention all day long, and it's hard to focus and to zone in on the things that you want to zone in on instead of other things. So I felt that frustration too, like a lot of people do, I think. But then related to that, I teach a short class once a year at the School of Visual Arts, a design class. And one of my big themes is getting students to pay attention to things that other people have overlooked. I think it's an important part of the design process, but of many processes, right? That's kind of the beginning of innovation and progress or whatever. It's like noticing what others have overlooked. And what I had noticed in students is that they often felt, because of this kind of attention economy that we're in right now, they would sometimes feel that, like, well, if they were interested in something, but no one else, like, it wasn't trending, it wasn't hot, it wasn't a topic of discussion, that maybe it wasn't important, you know? And I thought that's a disastrous outcome. Like, this is like, you can't go through life just paying attention to what everyone else pays attention to. And so I thought about this as a subject of a book. And what happened was, for a long time, the idea was going to be a book that would kind of spend a lot of time explaining the problem and then have this section at the back with, like, here are some things you can do in your life, add to your life to try to get your attention back, try to get your, you know, focus back. And I gradually finally realized that I was not really interested in explaining the problem because everybody already knew it. I was just interested in the tips. So the tips ended up sort of taking over the book. So now it's a short introduction saying, here's the problem. And then, as you say, there's 131. My publisher doesn't like me to call them assignments, but they're prompts or exercises or games or provocations to get you things you can add to your life and add to your kind of daily practice that will get you back to controlling your own attention, at least from time to time, you know, just devoting a bit of your day or your week to these things and making them fun and getting some control back.
So, okay, well, we won't talk about the problems. Everyone knows there's a problem.
Yeah.
But let's talk about like the benefits that come whenever right. you experience that focus and that attention, or when you notice things that people overlook. I mean, what are the opportunities there? And like, how does noticing things that get overlooked make us feel more human?
Right. So there's kind of a range of answers to that. And different kinds of people respond to different ways of approaching this. So on a very practical, I think, level, there's a lot of artists in the book, because artists are really good at noticing things and at drawing our attention to stuff that we had missed. But it's also, if you think about it, that's what an entrepreneur does. And that's what an inventor does. And that's what a good manager does, is notice things that other people overlooked. And whether that's a problem that needs to be solved, or whether that's something great that's overlooked that needs to be celebrated, or whether it's something puzzling that needs to be explained. And, you know, I mentioned design earlier. That's what a designer does. I remember meeting, in the course of my work as a journalist, interviewing Johnny Ive years and years ago, the Apple guy. And the way he critiqued, this was so long ago that I was using an analog tape recorder, and the way that he sort of, his comments about the way that that object was designed, it was like, this guy just sees the world in a different way. Like, he picks up on details that the rest of us miss. So there are these really practical reasons to work on these skills, to sort of build the attention muscles. But then at the other end of the spectrum, I think just as important is this kind of softer side of it, of, you know, just maintaining focus and maintaining a kind of control over your own engagement with the world, being present. Sounds a little like meditation mindfulness stuff. It kind of is. And there's a reason that the mindfulness idea is so popular right now, at the same time that we're trying to fend off all of these distractions, is that it's a way of reconnecting with yourself, of being really present with other people, just very, very practical day-to-day stuff that I feel like we all, whether you're a manager or whether you're a parent, sometimes we just need to be able to pull back, disconnect from other people's attempts to control our attention, and pay attention to what matters to us, and kind of identify what matters to us so that we're paying attention to the right things.
And that feels good when you identify and you actually pay attention to the things you want to pay attention to. Like, it just feels good. Or whenever you get that insight you figured out on your own without having to go to the internet to figure out, like, it's empowering. It just feels awesome.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, you know, and it's obvious in some of the big ways, but then there are at least small victories that you can have along this, of just like, I mean, the most workaday things, like just when you're walking the dog, right? I see people walking the dog and checking their phone. And it's like, why are you doing, you know, like, don't, you don't need to know what's trending on Twitter right now. Be present in the world that you and your dog are occupying. And maybe you'll notice, I don't know, pay attention. I like to sort of try to figure out what my dog is paying attention to. And he'll make me notice things like, oh, there's a bird over there that I wasn't tuned into. And, you know, it just makes you feel like, oh, I'm here. I'm not somewhere else. I'm actually here.
So let's walk through some of these prompts you talk about in the book. Because as you said, I think a lot of people, this muscle of noticing is atrophied because we've had these external sources tell us what to pay attention to. So it's helpful to have, you know, sort of a prompt to guide this as we, you know, strengthen that noticing muscle. The first one you talk about is creating, you know, scavenger hunts for yourself. What does that look like, and how do you decide what to look for?
Yeah, this was it's the first exercise in the book, because it was sort of the gateway drug for me personally to think about this. Now, it came from the example that I share in the book, is that I was making a business trip to San Francisco, a city I've been to a number of times, beautiful city, but like, I'd been there enough times that I, you know, I don't want to say I was over it, but you know, I was past that sort of crush phase that you have in a city that's that beautiful. And I was going to be really busy. I was going to be running around. I did not have time to do any proper sightseeing. So I wanted to give myself an assignment. of something to look for everywhere I went. And my only criteria, and this is kind of important, is that it had to be something that nobody else particularly wanted me to look at. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, I wasn't responding to somebody else's prompt. It was my prompt. And so the thing I chose was security cameras, which was a little bit arbitrary. I wasn't like working on a project related to that or anything. I just like, security cameras. And everywhere I went, it really was an eye-opener to see how pervasive they are and to see how they're treated differently. There are some that are kind of flashy, like they want to be noticed. And then there are some that are kind of stealthily hidden that don't want to be noticed. But it also shifts your gaze when you're looking at for something specific like that. So you're kind of just looking around in a different way and you're kind of looking past the street advertisements and the people trying to get your attention. And it was so much fun. And I did end up writing about this later, but it was so much fun that I still to this day, I look at security cameras everywhere I go. But at the end of that trip, I got to the airport and, you know, called my wife to say, hey, plane's on time, whatever. And like, hey, she knew I was doing this and that I was taking pictures. And I said, hey, and you would not believe the security camera situation at the airport. It's bananas. And she said, Rob, just please do me a favor and don't walk all around the airport taking pictures of all the security cameras. Which was good advice.
Right. No, I've done the security camera. I've done that too. Like I'll go into a store and just see how many security cameras I can find, which is fun. Another one, you know, you suggest looking for abandoned payphones, which I've done as well. And those are harder and harder to find.
Well, I think here's the interesting thing about that is that if they're hard to, it's sort of, it tells you something about the neighborhood you're in some ways. If there are a lot of abandoned payphones around, I like to look, another one I like to look for is no loitering signs. That's another tell as to if you're like, there are certain neighborhoods where there will be a lot of no loitering signs and there are some neighborhoods where there won't be any. So, and I've liked to look for in the past, I've looked for, neighborhood watch signs. You know, the neighborhood watch with the sort of shady criminal guy
right? Yeah. Side eye.
And when we lived in Savannah, I used to particularly, I got obsessed with ones that had been graffitied in some way because I just thought it was funny that if your neighborhood watch sign has been defaced, like maybe you have a problem.
Yeah, you don't have a neighborhood watch. So you started the security camera thing without any goal in mind, but you said it later on, it paid off because it gave you a story idea.
Yeah, well, I write a lot about design stuff. And so both neighborhood watch signs and security cameras, when I wrote a little bit about my experience for Design Observer and people sent me examples. It turned out to be kind of an interesting design subject because there are places where there is actually Europe where they've actually given thought to what security cameras could look like. Cause I think that the visual impact of a security camera right now is kind of negative. When you see them, it makes you tense. So there are places where they've tried to sort of make them softer seeming. And so anyway, the point is that it became, and this is, I mean, I'm a journalist and this is part of what a journalist does for a living too, is try to pick up on things that are right in front of you, but no one's paying attention to, you know, break from the quote unquote pack. Or find a different spin on. My favorite example of this is Jimmy Breslin's, when, you know, like everybody else, he had to cover the JFK funeral in the 60s. But he was the one who came up with the unique angle to write about the guy who dug the grave, right? Mm. So he spent the day with the guy who dug the grave. And that's sort of thinking in a different way outside the pack. And that piece is considered a sort of classic of journalism.
So a similar exercise to the scavenger hunt is starting a collection, but you suggest getting more conceptual than say I'm collecting stamps or baseball cards. What does your idea of a collection look like?
Yeah. Well, so I should credit here and I should say that once I got going on it, you know, I was explaining how I sort of headed off in this direction. Once I started thinking, I want to make this about suggestions, things people can do. A lot of them I made up, but then a lot of them came from reading and things other people had done. And then I interviewed people and came up with ideas from them. And then I got my students involved. But so one that was inspired by someone else, there's this guy, George Nelson, who's a furniture designer, who wrote a book in the 70s called How to See. But it wasn't really How to See. It was really How He Saw. it was essentially a collection of things he had noticed, photography and stuff. And he was my inspiration for this one because he was a collector of of images of, but images drawn from reality. So he would just take pictures of like every arrow he could spot, every clock, every manhole cover, you know, certain geometric shapes. And then he would get really interestingly conceptual of contrasts, like hard and soft. So a flag outside of a concrete building or whatever. And I was just, I love his inventiveness around this. And you could almost pick anything. Right now I'm collecting, as it were, the sort of structures at the top of, I guess they're telephone. I mean, are they telephone poles or power poles? They had these big rickety weird collections of hardware up there that I guess are running power. I don't even know. But it's this kind of thing that we're trained not to pay attention to, that we're trained to just zone out and look past. And that's the kind of stuff I find it really fun and exciting to look at. And then the birds that are up there, stuff like that. That's what I'm collecting right now. So that's the collection idea. You can take pictures as he did. And I know people who do this on Instagram who take pictures of traffic cones, or a friend of mine does close-ups of telephone poles, which is really weird, but they're fascinating. And it's a different way of taking in the world.
Yeah, that's a point where your tool that is often the source of distraction can be a tool used to notice more. So you might actually not have to take, you know, share it on Instagram, but you just start your little collection, yeah. Have your little collection in your phone of your contrasts, yeah. That you find,
yeah.
In the world.
Or you could not bother to take pictures at all. I mean, I don't take pictures. And I think that this is an important point to make, actually, because I think that sometimes there's certain kind of people who react to this stuff by thinking like, oh, okay, so I need to make a dedicated Instagram account about this. And then it's like, no, you really don't. Like, everything doesn't have to be translated. And in some ways, there's a lot of reasons not to do that. Like, don't automatically convert every personal looking project into something that gets subjected to the marketplace, right? Where you have to start worrying about how many likes it's getting. If that happens, fine. But I just think that there's a lot of, it's not noticing and seeing and paying attention is a means to an end, but it can also be an end in itself. Like, it's really satisfying to just learn to take enjoyment from the act.
So another noticing activity you recommend is looking slowly.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so this is specifically sort of came out of the context of museums. There's actually a slow art day thing that happens every year, but you could do it anytime. And the basic premise of slow art day is that you get together with a group of people. You go to the museum, and instead of trying to, you know, you've been to museums and you've seen people spend, I think that the average is 8 seconds or something looking at any given painting, and people are practically trying to like run through the museum. So instead of doing that, you just decide you're going to look at only 5 things for 10 minutes each. And then afterward, you get together and talk about what you looked at and what you took in. So this is obviously a really different way of perception in general. We're so used to trying to rack up as many, you know, visual experiences as we possibly can. And I think people spend sometimes more time at museums reading the little placard next to the art as they do looking at the art. So if you force yourself to look at something for that long, it does shift your perception, and you obviously start to notice things that you overlooked at first. And maybe by the end of it, you even have a completely different understanding of the piece that you were looking at. So that's the essence of looking slowly.
And you can do this not just with art, but with other stuff. I think you talked about some design teacher that would say, tell the students, like, you have to look at this rock, but for like an hour.
Yeah. 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 Or packaging, or, you know, there's almost anything you can do this with. There's a different exercise in the book about looking out the window, which sounds like such a sort of, well, I try to have a range of things that are really super easy to do. Like, you know, the minute you pick up the book, you can start participating in this. But you could spend 10 minutes looking out a window that you've always walked past. I mean, think about that. Like, in your life, there's a window that you walk past all the time. Maybe you glance out to see if the, you know, the world is on fire, but you couldn't really tell me anything about what's the view from that window. And spend 10 minutes looking out a window and look at every edge of what you can perceive. Then do it again a week later and see what's changed, you know? So it's applicable in all kinds of contexts.
Yeah, Thoreau did like looking slowly exercises. He would just look at a plant or a bug for hours. Yes. Like the entire day.
Yes. And people are dismissive of that because it's like, well, you know, there was nothing to do and throughout time. Now you can play Pokemon Go or whatever. And it's true. We have more distractions at our fingertips, but there are good reasons to sometimes say, I don't need to do that. Like I want to pick up on, yeah, looking at watch, spend 10 minutes watching a bug crawl, you know. Kids do it and kids love it. And there's something to be said for reconnecting with that childhood innocence and wonder and seeing the world.
No, yeah, that you talk about kids have a natural disposition to do that. And I saw this firsthand. We were on vacation in Vermont, and my daughter, she's 5, we went to this river to go swim, but she was like in the shallow section and she was there for probably a half hour on her hands and knees, just looking. She was looking for rocks and she was looking for fish.
Beautiful.
And she just sat there for literally a half an hour.
Yeah.
And it's also fun to see her because she has her own little collections. She's got rock collections.
Yeah.
And she's always on the lookout for loose change and she finds it all the time because she knows where to look. Like she goes to places where people overlook. So we were at an ice cream store the other day and there was like a vending machine. And so she like went underneath the vending machine and she pulled out all this loose change. Like, oh, look what I found.
That's great. And it's great that you pick up on that, you know, and that you can, I'm always telling people like that kids are good inspiration for this kind of thing. And if you have access to a child, you know, take inspiration from like, pay attention to what they're paying attention to because they don't have that jaded feeling of having seen it all before. The world is full of wonder. Saul Bellow used to talk about trying to view the world like an alien. For kids, that comes naturally. They sort of are aliens, you know? It's all right. Novel to them. So they get very excited about things. And we shouldn't dismiss that. We should embrace it and we should be jealous.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season. And while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining. On the pants, you can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it.
Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show. So in museums, there's a lot of exercises you provided, like the slow looking. So just look at a painting for 10 minutes, 30 minutes, even if you're feeling bold. But the thing with museums, though, they're designed so that you pay attention to certain objects, right? Like there's a light and the way that things are put on the wall or on a pedestal. So what can we do in museums so we notice things that we're not supposed to notice?
Yeah, it's a really super interesting context because there's a lot of thought is put into making you pay attention to the right things and not, you're not supposed to be looking at the guards. You're not supposed to be noticing that, like, oh, it's kind of dusty on this vitrine or whatever. So in a nutshell, it's basically try to pay attention to things that you're not supposed to pay attention to. So among the things I suggest are in fact paying attention to the guards. I often will ask a guard what their favorite piece is. You know, you don't want to hassle these people. They're doing their job, but they have a different relationship to this room full of art than you will ever have. Like, they spend so much time there. I think I like to encourage people to tune into objects that could be art. And this is a little bit inspired by, because those spaces are so charged with, you know, importance, there have been a number of incidents. There was one, I think, in San Francisco where somebody left a pair of glasses on the floor and people started to just assume it was a piece. There were people gathering around this pair of glasses and taking pictures of it. So I like to say, like, look for things that aren't art, but could be. Maybe the fire extinguisher, maybe some security camera, perhaps. And then another one is, people don't pay attention to this, but, you know, when you're walking around a museum, you're often walking into, like, the, you know, the Rob Walker wing of the thing, like, and it's a name that's not really familiar to you. Here's a place where your phone is actually maybe useful. Like, go ahead and Google who is this person that this wing is named after, and see if there were any interesting things about them. Or in the case of, I actually got a chance to lead a museum walk in Dallas at the Dallas Museum of Art. And we did this, and there was this one collection of stuff that was displayed in a really idiosyncratic way. And that's because this donor who the wing was named after insisted on that format. So it's kind of interesting. You learn something that, not that the museum was hiding that, but that they weren't, it doesn't get foregrounded. So it gives you a completely different way of taking in the stuff that you're being asked to look at.
Yeah, I do that with the looking at the plaques of, like, who the donors were, like, at,
yeah.
Like, even at schools, you'll often see this, find out who they were. I like the idea of asking people at museums who you would not think to ask what their favorite piece of art was or is. Mm-hmm. And the idea that just came was ask a janitor. Mm-hmm. Right? Because sure. They're in there all the time. And yeah. you typically go, oh, janitor doesn't have an opinion about art. But no, they probably have their favorite piece of art.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and museums in general are, you know, they want people to approach the work with, different perspectives. You know what I mean? I think that they're thrilled to have that, and that they would like to have, they would like to have more people coming to the museum with a fresh or an open perspective that, yeah, like, let the guard lead the tour almost. I think that they're open to that. It's not an antagonistic thing. I think that they're into it because they are, but it's an interesting environment because you have this feeling that like you have to do it right, and you don't have to do it right. You can do it any way you want.
So everyone's probably seen those photos of masses of people surrounding some famous work of art, like the Mona Lisa, and they're snapping pics with their smartphone, which I never understand because it's like, your pic's going to be really crappy. But you recommend people don't take pictures at art museums, but rather draw art they see. Why is that?
Well, so drawing, and I cannot pretend that I am the inventor of this idea, but drawing in general is widely believed to, if you have to draw something, you look at it in a completely different way. You're looking at details, you're looking at shape, you're looking at form, you're engaging with it. Whether that is drawing another artwork or whether it's drawing, I have suggestion in the book of like draw everything on your desk. You know, you could draw what you see out the window. People's immediate reaction to this is always like, well, I can't draw. Well, you don't have to put these drawings on the internet. Just get yourself a notebook, a cheap notebook, because the point isn't to show off. The point is to work on your powers of perception. And just do one. Make a drawing. Don't worry about showing it to anyone. And then the next day, do another one. And then do another one. And just have fun with it. Don't worry if you're making faithful reproductions. Just think about how the act of drawing, it forces you to slow down. It forces you to pay attention to detail. It forces you to see. And that's a really important exercise. I try to make writers do it when I teach a different sort of workshop about writing about objects. And I encourage the participants in that to spend time. If you really want to learn how to describe something, try drawing it, and you'll force yourself to perceive it in this much more detailed way.
So a lot of opportunities to flex those noticing muscles at the museum, or even it's just in noticing and drawing things on your own desk. Another game you suggested for people to start noticing things is, if whatever situation you might be in, say you're at a restaurant, is you look at all the people involved who are there and ask yourself, what would be the plot of a heist story in this situation? So what does this exercise cause you to notice that you overlook?
There's a couple of people who I talked to for the book who, I'm a big fan of making up stories essentially about people around you as a way to pass the time. But I had Dan Ariely, the behavioral psychologist, talk about looking at forces, and Jeff Manock, the writer, talking about these kind of, heist plots and disaster scenarios and stuff like this. And, you know, it's 50-50. It's 50% imagination and 50% observation, and they fuel each other. And seriously, it is just a game, but it's more fun than checking Instagram to just speculate, like, okay, what clues can I pick up on? What do I think this person, like, who's the most likely, bad guy or whatever you want to say in the room? And then it makes you look at like, what are my escape routes? How is this room really designed? Why are these tables so close together? How do I route around? There's another thing in the book about this friend of mine who is always looking for the quickest way out of a party. He hates parties. And it just, it gives you a little reset, a different way of looking at it. I find this comes in super handy. And, you mentioned different scenarios, but I like it when I'm stuck in line, the security line at the airport. Great place to start making up stories, right? About in your head about who's going to do what, who's going to be the hero, who's going to be the problem.
Yeah, because you have to look at the people, their body language. So one guy might look like he's in a rush or he's nervous, and you look at what they're carrying. Like, why are they carrying that? Why are they wearing that t-shirt?
Are these people together? Are they not together?
Yeah.
Who are they? Like, maybe these other people, it's like, oh, I bet this person and this other person who are like 10 people apart, they're actually in league. It's fun. It's just fun. Now, obviously I should just put in the caveat that like, be discreet and sane about all this.
Right. Yeah. Well, you can just do it in your head. You don't have to like narrate it out loud.
Just bring it in your head. You're making time go by.
Well, I say similar to this, we've had a lot of self-defense experts come on the show and they talk about situational awareness where you're in a room, where you're in a building. The first thing you do is you figure out or you decide or observe where all the exits are at. Right.
Yeah.
Even the exits you might not notice because people forget, like say your grocery store, there's exits in the back, right? Where it says employees only. And you got to think about that because people overlook that.
Yeah. It is. It's absolutely a form of situational awareness, which I associate with, and I'm sure, do you know that book Left of Bang?
Yeah. We've had him on the podcast.
Yeah. I was going to say. And so, but this is a sort of situational awareness light. Like it's not, you're not sort of in the mindset. But that's a fine mindset to be in if you're just, you know, you're just using it to pass the time. You're not being paranoid or whatever. It's really interesting to think about that stuff and to try to, it is a way of engaging with the world as opposed to, you know, being the passive person who is just engaged with their phone. Another thing you can do is spy on what people are doing with their phones. I'm a big fan of that.
Mm. So what do you notice people doing with their phones?
My favorite anecdote about this, actually another San Francisco story, is I was on the, I do like to peek at what, you know, I kind of like discreetly looking over people's shoulders. And once I was on the BART in San Francisco and I was looking at like, what's that guy doing with his phone? And he was playing a game that, you know, it was a game that involved using your finger to direct a piece of trash into the garbage can, you know, like you would sit in your office and throw a wadded up piece of paper into the garbage can. It was that, but digital. Like that's what he was doing. But then, you know, a lot of people, the other thing that's great to look at is how people who are talking on the phone, like their body language, it's almost like a dance performance because they're reacting to the conversation that they're in, not the world that they're in. So they're gesturing with their hands and they're making facial expressions, all for some audience. And, you know, they're holding their phone in that weird way up to their mouth, like a tray.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And it looks like someone needs to do a dance performance that's based on phone conversation gestures. It's like a madcap visual poetry thing. I love it. I recommend. And that's something good to draw as well.
So another exercise is find something you weren't looking for. What does that look like?
So this was inspired by, have you ever had Davy Rothbart on the
no
show? So he's this guy who he's this zine and then podcast and books and all kinds of stuff called Found. And he is a proponent of like, you're walking down the street, you see a piece of trash blow by that has some handwriting on it. Don't kick it out of your way. Pick it up and look at it. You weren't looking for it, but, and he has built a whole kind of mini empire of like, finding these fascinating. It started for him with someone left a note on his car that they mistook his car for their ex-boyfriend's car or something. And said like, I can't believe you're here and you're seeing her again, aren't you? And all this stuff, this crazy note. And then at the end of this hostile note, it said like, text me later. And he realized there was a whole novel practically built into this like random thing that he wasn't looking for. So he says, like, you know, a lot of times you'll pick up a piece of discarded writing somewhere on the street and it'll be nothing. But one out of every 10 times, one out of every 20 times, there's a little story in there. And, you know, it's an opportunity, again, to be surprised and delighted by something you weren't looking for.
Right. Grocery lists can tell a story.
Grocery lists can be really interesting. Yeah, they're worth scrutiny. They're worth a little bit of attention.
I had a friend, this reminded me, in high school, this was before cell phones. So whenever you wanted to communicate to somebody, you wrote notes, right? In school, he would collect notes that he found on the ground that are discarded, and then he would turn them into songs.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
Which was, again, some of them were really like poignant because these are you know, angsty, like teenage love letters. But other ones are just silly because, you know, teenagers are silly.
That's perfect though. I mean, that's a way of embracing the universe and taking it as like, this isn't trash. This is potential inspiration and it's a personal challenge. What can I do with this? You know, how can I convert this thing that was literally discarded by the world? How can I redeem it, turn it into some piece of creativity? I mean, that's, again, one of the reasons there are so many artists in the book is that the artists are so good at recognizing that the overlooked is the beginning of creativity.
So we've been talking about noticing with our eyes. because that's what people think of, but we can notice things with our other senses. What are some things that we can do to notice with our ears, our smell, our taste, et cetera?
Yeah. The book's actually set up this way. We start with visual stuff and then it moves into the other senses for exactly this reason, because I think that people immediately associate, when you say noticing, they immediately think visual. But there are a couple of things that I would suggest. One that I do in my life all the time is this. It's in the book. It's described as, there's a famous John Cage composition called 4:33 that, when it was first performed, consisted of someone sitting in front of the piano and not playing it for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Now, this was not a very popular piece when it was performed, but, you know, it's a comment. It's, people read it as a comment on silence, but it's really a comment on listening. And it's really a comment on engaging with everything you can and can't hear. So I suggest hijacking that and covering, as the way a cover band would cover something, cover 4:33, which you can do at any time. You can not play the piano for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And I'll literally do this. I'll put my phone on the timer on 4:33 and just sit in my office and see what sounds come at me, which could be, I live in New Orleans. I work at home in a residential neighborhood, my office points at a quiet street. So there might be some bird song. There might be a train in the distance. My neighbor Peter might be out holding forth on the porch, as he does from time to time. And you kind of, over time, build up a little sort of like repertoire of what are the sounds of my neighborhood. So that's the sort of challenge that I put in the book, is think about having a, what if you had to draw a map of the most interesting sounds in your neighborhood, the five most interesting sounds. Then you can extend that to other senses. What if you had to do a map of the five most interesting smells in your neighborhood? And there are artists who have done elaborate smell walk tours of cities, you know, trying to sort of capture, and we all know how visceral that sense of smell can be. Or you could build something around textures. Taste is trickier.
Right. You don't want to go lick in buildings or whatever.
You don't really want to go lick building, but you can think about, you could think about five tastes that define your neighborhood, with being, restaurants and things like that. And then in the book, I even get into the idea of, Duchamp talked about this idea of the infrathin, which is stuff that's kind of beyond the five senses, like the feeling of the chair that someone has just gotten out of. Mm. Things that kind of don't really get, so that gets kind of advanced, but it's fun to think about, like, what senses are, what can I detect that doesn't even fall within the five senses? And it becomes, you know, again, it becomes game-like.
I licked buildings when I was a kid.
And you're still here to tell the tale.
I'm still here to tell the, no, when I read that about taste, and that's the very, you can lick it. And I was like, I did that. Cause I remember the memory came flooding back. You know, I grew up in Oklahoma City, and we did our banking at the Murrah building that, uh-huh, you know, was bombed. But I remember distinctly licking that building for some reason. And
wow,
your book helped me remember that. So,
well, I mean, maybe we could convert it into, like, you don't want to lick buildings, but like, be really ambitious and adventurous about, like, where you can taste things as you move about your city or your neighborhood or the neighborhood you work in. And short of licking buildings, but like, where taste can be found. Yeah. That's a good challenge.
Yeah. Rocks have taste. People don't, they do have a taste to them. So we also talk about, in the book, you talk about, like, the role of solitude in noticing. What's the role? Do you think most noticing is an individual thing, primarily, or can you do this with a group?
You can do both. And there's the way that what happens next in the way the book is structured, the way the exercises are organized, is there's a batch that are specifically designed to help you in noticing other people, basically. But then it does end on a more personal, inward note, with ideas about, and I think this is important now, to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning. There are very logical reasons why we need to be aware, you know, why that fear of missing out thing is real. Like, we want to be generally aware of what the pack, the tribe, the society is thinking about, but it's also kind of vital, and it's harder now, to take that time to devote to yourself, to devote to your own reflection. So some of the ideas literally come down to, in one case, make an appointment with yourself. The same way that you make appointments all week long with people for work reasons or social reasons or whatever. Give yourself that hour a week where, and this came from Mike Birbiglia talking about, the way he put it was, you have an appointment with your brain at Thus and So Cafe. This is so he could work on a personal project and feel like that's as important, and you have to honor that as much as you honor business meetings. And then I had a student who, I make my students invent their own exercise, attention exercise. And I had a student who said, oh, I misunderstood the assignment. I did it wrong. Because what I did was I bought a cactus and I took care of it for a week. And I said, okay, that's definitely not what I had in mind. But caring for something is the ultimate, you know, act of attention. And that is the goal of building those attention muscles, is to make sure that you're paying attention to what you care about and you care about what you're paying attention to.
Well, Rob, this has been a fun conversation. Like, there's a ton more of these exercises in the book. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
So the best place to go is robwalker.net. And robwalker.net/noticing is the section that has stuff about the book, including the... there's a newsletter that comes out every week or two where I share new exercises or ideas that I've come up with since the book, and also the very popular icebreaker of the week feature where I get people to submit. And if you have listeners who have a good icebreaker question, I really hope that they'll zoom on over there and submit it, because that's a reader-driven feature. So that's the best place. I'm on Twitter at @notrobwalker. And Facebook at facebook.com/consumed. So any of those places are good.
So the icebreaker, that's intrigued me. What is like the most bizarre or interesting icebreaker prompt you've gotten?
Well, this is a little bit of a cheat, because it's something that I got from, and I give her, Whitney, her name's Whitney, who she in some ways inspired this whole thing, and has this amazing, had this amazing question that I experienced in real life. I was seeing her for, it was part of a group work thing, and we were at lunch, and she had this question about whether, under the right circumstances, if you were offered a chance to eat human flesh, but you were guaranteed that no one would, like, the, for what, how, somehow no one was harmed, would you taste it? Would you taste it? And listening to people answer that and like their rationales and the looks on their faces, I know that sounds weird, but it's really interesting. It's a really good icebreaker.
Yeah, do that on your first date.
do not do that on your first date.
Dating advice from Rob Walker. Ask if you're...
No.
Well, Rob, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Listen, I really appreciate it. You were great.
My guest today was Rob Walker. He's the author of the book, The Art of Noticing. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You find out more information about his work at his website, robwalker.net. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/noticing, where you can find links to resources, where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives. There's over 500 episodes there, as well as thousands of articles we've written over the years on personal finance, physical fitness, how to be a better husband, better father, you name it, we've got it. And if you'd like to enjoy new episodes ad-free of the Art of Manliness podcast, you can do so in Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, use code manliness to get a month free trial of Stitcher Premium. And once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, start listening to ad-free episodes of the Art of Manliness podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only to listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.